Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and with me now, three deans of Washington political analysis, E.J. Dionne, Norman Ornstein, and Thomas Mann. Together, they have a new book called One Nation After Trump, a guide for the perplexed, the disillusioned, the desperate, and the not yet deported. You know these authors, E.J. Dionne, columnist for the Washington Post, senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, professor at Georgetown University, contributor to All Things Considered, Norman Ornstein, resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute and a contributing editor and columnist for National Journal and The Atlantic. They are the authors of a recent New York Times bestseller, actually in various combinations. E.J. Dionne was here recently for Why the Right Went Wrong, and Mann and Ornstein together for It's Even Worse Than It Looks, and Thomas Mann, resident scholar at the Institute of Government Studies at the University of California at Berkeley and senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, rounds out the trio. Welcome all of you to WNYC. Thank you so much for coming on today. I should say welcome back. Hi.
It's a joy to be with you always, Brian.
Hi, Brian.
So, EJ, let me start with you. We're in the throes of Trump world right now. Why call this book One Nation After Trump?
Well, because we wanted to call attention to the fact that on the one hand, Donald Trump, we think, is a real threat to norms. He is tearing up political norms, but it's also a continuation of that breakdown. We worry that he has authoritarian tendencies. He's a real problem. But we also want to call attention to two things. One, there has been a real mobilization against him. It's not just demonstrations. It's also a lot of people getting involved in politics, knowing now, if they didn't know it before, that if you sit aside, some bad things can happen to the Republic. And we wanted to offer some ideas about how to move forward. So we'll have a chance to talk about it. We have some ideas about a new economy, a new civil society, a new patriotism, and also a new democracy. That he used that phrase, drain the swamp. He is not draining the swamp. He's making it thicker. But we have some ideas about how you really might drain the swamp if you were serious about it.
All right. So I'll bite. Norm, you want to talk about your charter for American working families, including a GI Bill for American workers?
Sure. And this, I think, reflects something that EJ just emphasized. We can't move forward unless we have a kind of policy agenda that can get some broader level of support and that deals, in this case, with what is one of the larger, longer-term and looming problems that we've had, which is the yawning inequality and the struggles that have been there for working families to be able to fulfill, when they've done their part of the social contract, the other part, which is that if you work hard and do what you're supposed to do, you'll have at least some kind of reasonable roof over your head for you and your family. You'll be able to put food on the table and have a life, an education for your kids. So we've got a whole set of proposals, some of which have come from major figures in our political system, including proposals by Sherrod Brown, Elizabeth Warren, and others. Others that have come from the right, in fact, to try and make sure that you have reasonable wages, a safety net for people, and make it the equivalent of a GI Bill, which transformed America in so many ways and created an educated class and resulted in a productive economy.
What's an example of one of those that's come from the right? I think a lot of listeners in the New York area, which is such, you know, a blue or liberal or progressive area, think they hear only from the right, oh, the market should take care of all. The contract is if you work hard, you'll be okay, that kind of thing.
So, you know, for an existing policy and one that's continuing to be supported by conservative economists and others, we've got the earned income tax credit. But we also have some of my colleagues at AEI who have proposed a version of the German job-sharing plan, where instead of laying people off when difficult economic times come, people share jobs, and it's a win-win. you're able to maybe work a few hours less, but to keep your job and your benefits. It's subsidized to some degree by government. And then when things turn better, the company doesn't have to go out and hire new people and train them. They've got their educated and competent workforce. My colleague Michael Strain had a proposal for a relocation voucher for people who, if you have difficult economic times like we had in 2008 and 2009, and there's no job in the area where you're living, but you can't possibly afford to move and pay a damage deposit on rent to a place where there might be jobs that fit your skill set. So there are things where we can find some common ground and find some compromises. And it's a tragic reality of our times, and one that's not being made better by either Donald Trump or Speaker Paul Ryan and his colleagues in the House, or Majority Leader Mitch McConnell and his colleagues in the Senate, that they're doing nothing to try and bridge these gaps.
Listeners, any phone calls for E.J. Dionne, Norman Ornstein, and Thomas Mann, author now of One Nation After Trump, A Guide for the Perplexed, the Disillusioned, the Desperate, and the Not Yet Deported, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. And Thomas Mann, I see the book also has a contract for American social responsibilities. Contract suggests different sides agreeing to something. Is it that?
No, it really is. It really is different. What has happened is that the original conception of corporate form involves some broad social responsibilities, not just to shareholders, but to workers and to consumers and to citizens of the country. And as Steve Perlman, a sort of superb columnist for the Post and now professor, has outlined, until we get away from the focus on short-term values, so much of the energy of the corporate world is involved in financial manipulations and little opportunities for the rest of society to benefit in any meaningful way. So we have a set of proposals arguing that the corporate form comes not just with advantages for those forming and leading such corporations, but responsibilities to a whole set of other constituencies. And this is something that had been done in the past. The great achievements of the American economy really occurred in the 20th century when corporations partnering with governments were able to produce strong economic growth that was widely shared with genuine opportunities for social and economic mobility. Those have diminished greatly, and we want to offer a much more hopeful, optimistic vision to the one offered by President Trump, which is exceedingly dark and zero sum. Mm. And I think the book does that.
EJ?
Just real quickly, Steve Perlstein sort of argues that this is the tradition of the American corporation before the last 30 or 40 years. We moved away from an idea that used to be very American, which is that the corporation had responsibilities to stakeholders and not simply to shareholders. And he and Bill Galston, Elaine Kmark, and others have put together very concrete proposals that would change the incentives for corporations to think more long-term, more about their communities, and more about their employees.
Well, EJ, it seems like the book is kind of optimistic about a reasonable backlash to Trump, a national soul-searching and democratic renewal, an outbreak of reasonableness, while what I think we keep seeing and hearing everybody say is, oh, Trump happened because the country is so polarized and it's going to be as polarized after Trump. It's not just about this individual, extreme and objectionable as he may be as an individual. So of what nature and where do you see signs of this reasonable backlash rather than continued fraying into political tribes?
Right. If I could say we are under no illusions about the country. We don't pretend the country isn't polarized. There is a lot of polarization in the country. There's a lot of partisan polarization. There's a lot of tribalism. There is polarization in the way people consume media. So we're very clear about that book and about that development. And so the question is, well, then how in the world can you guys be so optimistic? And the answer is that I think Trump has exposed some long-term problems that the country had that we were hoping might take care of themselves. And I think it's very clear to Americans that, as I said at the beginning, norms have been breaking down for a long time. He is carrying that to a logical and very dangerous conclusion. It's very clear that the attacks on the media, that media has problems on both ends. On the one hand, a kind of false balance took hold where you had to say each side was always the same when they weren't. I think you're seeing a correction on that in the media, where there's a lot of my colleagues saying, look, our first obligation is to the truth. And if people attack us for telling the truth, so be it. And but most important, I think that there is a lot of evidence across the country. You saw of people getting active again on behalf of democratic values. You saw it in all those town halls on behalf of the health care bill, where a lot of people who didn't particularly like Obamacare in sort of the abstract suddenly looked at it and said, wait a minute, what this proposal is trying to do is actually good for the country. You're seeing people get involved in precinct party committees, running for city council, a lot of groups recruiting new and young candidates for office. I think there's a staying power to this that goes beyond what you've seen with other protest movements and other presidents. And that's why we're optimistic. Lastly, I think we all recognize that we have to defend an American idea of patriotism, which is not rooted in blood and soil and your color or what country you came from. It's rooted in a commitment to values embodied in the Constitution itself that begins with the words, we the people, and the Declaration of Independence. All men are created equal. And we want to sort of stand up for American values that go all the way back to the beginning.
Asher in Croton-on-Hudson. You're on WNYC with E.J. Dionne, Norman Ornstein, and Thomas Mann. Hi, Asher.
Yes, so in such distinguished company. Thank you so much. I think the Democrats have made a mistake of getting lost, looking for the trees and ignoring the forest. I think the various investigations, including criminal and congressional, that they think are going to lead to the impeachment of Mr. Trump are probably not going to have that result and are going to make him more arrogant and stronger. However, he is the most transformative president that we've had in the modern era. He has changed the nature of the presidency. And I think prior to January 20, the Democrats should have put Trump on notice that on January 20th, they would walk out of Congress, do absolutely no participation.
Asher, by that standard, I'm sorry, until what? Until what?
Until he disclosed his taxes, until he agreed to disclose the various...
So by that standard, are you unhappy that they might do a deal with him on DACA?
Actually, I don't think they've made or can or really will make a deal on DACA.
Asher, thank you very much. So Thomas Mann, what do you think about the present moment? Because there's a lot of analysis that the reasonable backlash, if you will, is already starting to set in, that Trump is realizing, just as a matter of his own political analysis, that he can't build his legacy by continuing to throw political hand grenades into the populace and, you know, Steve Bannon style or Breitbart style, hope that that's going to polarize the country ultimately to his political benefit. And that's why we're suddenly seeing potential compromises, at least on DACA, on taxes, maybe the Iran deal, maybe the climate Paris Accords. What do you think?
I think you should slow down with your enthusiasm or at least hopefulness with respect to Donald Trump. He really is bad. He really is unsuited for this office. He has no clear ideology. He's a man that's consumed with his own performance and the reactions to it, especially by cable news, and he moves by his gut. He was getting nothing from the Republicans on the Hill, a really dreadful record by Ryan and McConnell, so he saw an opportunity to get a good storyline, and out of that may come some important accomplishments. Democrats have responsibilities for the Dreamers to try to keep them from being deported, so it makes sense on certain matters to look to make some deals. But the longer story is that what's needed is to limit the damage that Trump can do while in office, to hasten the time at which he leaves, but most importantly, to begin the activity and the preparation for reforming and rebuilding our democracy in his wake. He will be gone at some point, and we have to be prepared to deal with the long-term problems that made his election possible.
So, Norm Ornstein, to that point, let's say he is impeached or forced to resign. Do things get any better when Mike Pence is president of the United States? I get calls every couple of days now from somebody without even raising the question, if we're looking at the Russia investigation details or anything like this, saying, don't impeach Trump. Don't encourage this, because then Trump will resign and it'll be even worse because Mike Pence believes in all the same horrible policies from a progressive point of view, that but he'll be more effective at bringing them in because he won't be such a lightning rod for being, you know, so personally outrageous. What do you think about that?
So there's a couple of points to make here, Brian, and some of them I think we emphasize in the book. Donald Trump is not the root of the problem here. There are reasons why he got elected, and a lot of them are based in the way the Republican Party has changed, including shredding norms and moving towards a radical element away from problem-solving, even a conservative problem-solving orientation. And getting rid of Trump, if it happens and when it happens, is not going to magically transform the world. I know Mike Pence from his time in Congress. He's an affable man. There would be some real differences. We're not likely to have a Twitter war with Kim Jong-un that could lead to a nuclear conflict. We're not likely to have the same kind of bombastic, race-baiting, and anti-Muslim and other outrageous things and neo-Nazi support, in a sense, that we're getting from Trump very directly. But where Trump is policy-free, and in knowledge and in orientation, Mike Pence is a genuine, very radical ideologue. If you want to see what a Pence presidency would look like to start with, there's a good portion of it in the Trump presidency with Mick Mulvaney, with Zinke, yeah. And with Tom Price. These are his people, and Betsy DeVos, among others. We would have more conservative policies and probably some of it done more effectively. But the threat and the direct threat to the fundamentals of our political system are sharper right now under a president who is, I think, a natural autocrat and kleptocrat.
Chris in Tarrytown, you're on WNYC. Hi, Chris.
Hi, how are you?
Okay.
What I wanted to say is, why is nobody talking about the Electoral College and how it was basically the Electoral College that swung the election, not the popular vote? I mean, Hillary won by 3 million votes. So basically, the base of the country is not for Trump, but by gerrymandering and all the other things that may be going on with the Russians.
For you.
Yes, have you
yes we have the book for you.
Go ahead, EJ.
Bless you for saying that. The whole first chapter of our book emphasizes just what you said, that we think it is very important to realize that the whole country did not become Trumpian, that Trump received not only fewer votes than Hillary Clinton, but if you put together all the other candidates, he received way fewer votes than a majority. And we call for reform of the Electoral College, we argue, in fact, that our democracy has become anti-majoritarian. The Senate, which is hard to change, is vastly underrepresents the larger states. By 2050, 70% of the people will live in 15 states. That means that they'll have 30 senators. This is a problem. Gerrymandering creates a non-majoritarian democracy. The way campaign money works works against majoritarian democracy. So our whole first chapter is very much directed at the problems inside the political system. And it's very important to remember that Trump was not the plurality candidate in this election, because we shouldn't pretend that we have become Donald Trump's country. Most Americans started out uneasy or unhappy with Trump, and now more are unhappy with Trump's presidency. And that should hearten us as Americans.
On the gerrymandering, Tom, we've talked many times on this show, and I see you bring it up in the book. The most stark, the easiest way to communicate how unfair the congressional districts in the House are right now is that in the 2012 election, more Americans voted for Democrats for House of Representatives than voted for Republicans, and yet the Republicans wound up with a clear majority. There is that suit before the Supreme Court now on political gerrymandering. Do you think if the justices rule the right way, that that has the potential to seriously fix this?
It's certainly not a silver bullet, but it's exceedingly important. This is the most critical case before the Supreme Court on gerrymandering that we have had. And finally, those working on this issue have come up with objective ways of measuring the partisan manipulation of legislative boundaries that are separate from just the natural geographical distribution of voters. And Wisconsin is the perfect example of that. It's the most gerrymandered state in the country. And therefore, the hearing is coming up soon, and I think the outcome is uncertain. But if it passes, it will provide another tool for those trying to get fair representation of the voters' preferences.
And on the Electoral College, Norm, is it in a way worse than it ever was because of the fact that the nature of the polarization that we have today in the country is so urban versus rural, with, you know, the more liberal and more diverse urban areas and the more conservative and more very white rural areas. And so many of the states, the smaller states that don't have a lot of population, are rural, and they get the same two senators that California gets, that New York gets, that Florida gets. And so given our current politics, given our current population distributions and their politics, the Electoral College is even makes the election of the president even less representative of the people than it ever was before?
Exactly so. And we go into this in great detail in the book, Brian. This is a different phenomenon than we've ever had before. And we've now had two of the past five elections where the winner of the popular vote lost the presidency. You get more of those, and there's a dramatic crisis of legitimacy in the country. We're getting large groups of people who are, in effect, unrepresented in a presidential election because of the rural and small state biases built into the Electoral College. There are a host of reasons why our entire political system is being tilted away from the kind of responsiveness to majorities and moving away from a responsiveness to the increasing diversity that we have in the country. And you can only do this for so long before people, as they did after 2000, said, well, this is bad, but, you know, those are the rules, realizing that the rules are increasingly tilted in an unfair direction. It's something we really have to grapple with.
And we have to leave it there. I'd say there were about 400 other pages that we didn't get to discuss from the new book.
It's not that long a book, Brian. It's a nice, compact book for people, just so they know.
And we're happy to come back for the rest of it, Brian.
That's right. There you go. I've got, 479-80, including the notes. It's called One Nation After Trump, A Guide for the Perplexed, the Disillusioned, the Desperate, and the Not Yet Deported. by E.J. Dionne, Norman Ornstein, and Thomas Mann. Thank you all so much.
Thanks so much,
Brian.
Thank you.